First of all, I want to thank Nancy for the choosing that hymn and Jim with the story, because it does pertain to how to relate to people we have conflicts with. So compassion from that point of view. It's great to be compassionate towards someone who's suffering, someone who's nice, but someone we're mad at or see as the enemy could be within our own family temporarily, or it could be a much larger issue, the Taliban, or depending if you're a Palestinian or an Israeli, the other side. That's where it really gets to be tough. Anyway, I wanted to thank you both. I thought that I didn't know what hymns to suggest, and when Nancy picked out that one, "There's a Wideness in Your Mercy," I thought, boy, that really expressed pretty well how to go beyond our own individual narrow vision, which we don't see as narrow, in order to relate to a person or a group of people that we have major conflicts with. It could be pro-choice, pro-life, it could be any kind of division. Anyway, as John mentioned, I'm in this book group with a number of people, wonderful people, and one book we read last spring by a man named Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, really struck me. It's called The Happiness Hypothesis, and I'm going to refer to that. However, the germ, as it were, for this started about 3 years ago. I was visiting my ex-wife. Her name's Bonnie Smith. We've remained on good terms after our divorce some 20-some years ago, and we usually talk every night on the phone. But anyway, she was in Phoenix at that time, and that's where she is now. And we got into a discussion somewhat about politics. And Bonnie tends to be fairly conservative in her views, a very strong sense of justice in human affairs, and we've had many disagreements. However, she has a quality that I realized I lacked. She's willing and able to listen to the other side. And I don't remember what the specific discussion was about. It was probably about something Bill O'Reilly had said, or Glenn Beck, two people she was listening to a lot, and I couldn't even think of listening to them. I wanted to end that, get away from it, and yet it bothered me that I couldn't listen to the other side without getting very upset. In fact, almost an inability to even consider what they had to say. So when I read this book in our book group, there was one title, it was a subtitle, "I'm Right, You're Biased." And I thought, wow, that's getting toward the heart of something that I struggle with and I think is widely shared. I did, by the way, share this talk with Monica Acree and last week, and she suggested maybe if there's time when I finish talking that it might be of some value for people to talk to the person or two people next to them if there's time and see if this does relate to you or ways in which it may. Anyway, I put together actually 3.5 pages, the first time I've typed a talk in about 40 years, so you folks are special. Anyway, I typed it primarily because I was copying ideas from other people that I really related to. So there are kind of three sections, and the first one's very abstract. It's some ideas from Carl Jung, psychiatrist, contemporary of Sigmund Freud, person who has a lot of influence, though, I think, in contemporary psychology and understanding. And then there's a little segment about how some of his ideas got presented in a little more pragmatic framework, the Johari window. And then lastly, a number of ideas from Jonathan Haidt's book, or Haidt's book, however his name is pronounced. So I'm just going to read through this a bit. Carl Jung developed an understanding of the human psyche. And one part of who each of us is, he called the shadow. The shadow consists of repressed weaknesses, shortcomings, and instincts. Jung wrote, "Everyone carries the shadow, and the less it is embodied in the person's conscious life, the blacker and denser it is. It is prone to projection, turning a personal inferiority into a perceived moral deficiency in someone else. The shadow personifies everything that the individual refuses to acknowledge about himself." If and when an individual makes an attempt to see his shadow, he becomes aware of, and often ashamed of, those qualities and impulses he denies in himself but can plainly see in others. It is a painful and a lengthy work of self-education to deal with our shadow. The struggle is to retain awareness of the shadow, but not identification with it. But to not identify requires considerable moral effort. However, by resisting that, we prevent a descent into the darkness. Understanding acts like a lifesaver. The more we understand ourselves, we can integrate these unconscious aspects of ourself and reincorporate the shadow into our personality, producing a stronger, wider consciousness than before. Sort of like that hymn, wider view of life and maybe understanding of others. People who follow Jung warn that the acknowledgement of the shadow must be a continuous process throughout one's life. Accepting one's shadow is, quote, "the grim process of washing one's dirty linen in private." And Jung also believed that in spite of its function as a reservoir for human darkness, or perhaps because of this, the shadow is often the seat of creativity. Well, that seems pretty abstract. However, if that's too abstract, the work of two people, Joseph Luft and Harry Ingham, in 1995, may help us understand it better. They developed a technique called the Johari window that many of you probably are familiar with. The purpose of this was to increase our awareness and understanding of ourselves. So this is, you can't see this where you are, I don't think, but to some extent it may illustrate it. If you think of four quadrants of this representing each one of us as individuals, this one up here represents that part of ourselves that is like an open arena. What I know about myself and what you know about me, or whoever the individual is. What's shared knowledge. This down here, the hidden part is what I know about me and you don't know about me. I may share this with you, and so this can get smaller, this can get larger. This up here, though, is interesting. This is the blind part. What you know about me and I don't know about myself. We often don't think of that. Other people know things about us that we're often blind to. And that's getting a little closer to the shadow, but this is really the shadow. There's an unknown part of us that neither we are fully aware of and others also have no knowledge of. That's probably the shadow. So this is often a technique used in group discussion, and it kind of illustrates what Jung was talking about. Okay. What are some of the aspects of oneself that are difficult to face? Well, one is feelings of inadequacy, feeling I was so stupid. Incompetency. I have an evening treatment group, and it's a group of men, and we're dealing with alcohol and drug problems. But especially as men, how men are not raised, we are not encouraged to deal with our feelings, especially maybe older men, maybe younger children, or even teenagers may have been raised somewhat differently. But dealing with feelings is often difficult. So I was asking them to write down or to come up with words describing feelings they have trouble with. And one was inadequacy. I think it was, or indecisiveness. And I couldn't spell it. I was trying to write it on the board. For some reason, my mind went blank. So I had the experience of incompetence. It wasn't a major life-changing thing, but it was interesting to experience something, not just talk about it. And other feelings, impotence, unworthiness, guilt, dependency, a need to control or manipulate in order to feel secure. And if these are brought to our conscious awareness before we're ready to deal with them, we use defenses, denial, we ignore it, we rationalize to resist dealing with them. Okay, well, that's the second part. The third part of this is, how does this affect, then, our relationship with other people? Jonathan Haidt, as I said, he's an associate professor of what's called positive psychology at the University of Virginia. He studied three great zones, as it were, of human classical thought, ancient India, China, and the cultures around the Mediterranean. And one of the most universal pieces of advice he found emerging in all these areas of thought and experience is that we are all hypocrites. Not a pleasant thought. I'm glad tomatoes are out of season. You might start throwing them at me at this point. Curing hypocrisy, he writes, is harder than curing depression, because we don't believe there's a problem. We have often the delusion that we are not, we are combatants. We're not caught up in it. He said, and I found this kind of interesting then, people are skilled at finding reasons to support their gut feelings. Haidt refers to what he calls the makes sense stopping rule. We take a position, look for evidence that supports it, and if we find some evidence, enough so that our position makes sense, we stop thinking. I was talking with, again, Bonnie last night, and she's stopped listening to anything about politics. She especially has come to recognize Fox News, and she sees MSNBC on two extremes. And what they each do is they bring up evidence to support their point of view. They tend not to bring out evidence to look at the strengths and point of view in each position to try to get to some mutual understanding. And that's kind of what Haidt is talking about. Over and over again, studies show that people set out on a cognitive mission to bring back reasons to support their preferred belief or action. We are usually successful, and we end up with the illusion of objectivity. He quotes Ben Franklin, who said, or wrote, "So convenient a thing it is to be a reasonable creature, since it enables one to find or make a reason for everything one has a mind to do." Two professors, Emily Prom at Princeton and Lee Ross at Stanford, refer to something called naive realism, by which each of us thinks we see the world directly as it really is. We further believe that the facts as we see them are there for all to see. Therefore, others should agree with us. It seems plain as day to the naive realist that everyone is influenced by ideology, self-interest, their own experience, except for me. I see things as they are. Naive realism is easily ratcheted up from the individual to the group level. My group is right because we see things as they really are. Naive realism gives us a world full of good and evil. This really speaks to me. You are a group of people I really like. I identify with. I see us sharing many common values. But I've been with other groups in my life that I also felt the same about. And now I find myself in conflict with them in some ways. Roman Catholic Church being one. I love the church, and yet I hate so many things about some of the rulings and attitudes. So how does this happen? How do we get beyond this? Can we get beyond it? Well, go on here, page 3, see what it says. Getting interested. Haight writes, you can spin a comparison with another person or group either by inflating your own claims or by disparaging the claims of others. The consistent finding of psychological research is that we are fairly accurate in our perception of others. It is our self-perceptions that are distorted because we tend to look at ourselves in a rose-colored mirror. That's why I went back to that idea of the shadow or the unknown quadrant. People really are open to information that will predict the behavior of others, but they refuse to adjust their self-assessments. A man named Robert Wright, with a W-R-I-G-H-T, wrote The Moral Animal, and he wrote, "Human beings are a species splendid in their array of moral equipment, tragic in their propensity to misuse it, and pathetic in their constitutional ignorance of its misuse." Pretty strong judgments against us. I came across a man named Peter Coleman from Columbia University. He studied conflicts over the last several hundred years throughout the world. And he wrote, he says, 1 in 20 difficult conflicts ends up not in calm reconciliation or a tolerable standoff, but as an acute and lasting antagonism. Such conflicts, the 5%, he calls them, can be found among the diplomatic and political clashes we read about every day in the newspaper, but also, and in no less damaging and dangerous form, in our private and personal lives, within families, in workplaces, and among neighbors. He refers to the work of a man named Ron Baumeister, a social psychologist who is the author of Evil: Inside Human Cruelty and Aggression. And Baumeister found that violence and cruelty have 4 main causes. The first is greed and ambition, but they explain only a small portion of violence. The second is sadism, but that explains even less. The 2 biggest causes of evil are 2 that we think of as good: high self-esteem and moral idealism. When someone's high self-esteem is unrealistic or narcissistic, it is easily threatened by reality. Threatened self-esteem accounts for a large portion of violence at the individual level. I think I'm being treated with disrespect. I know personally, I find that a trigger for anger or resentment. I ride along the bike path, smile at someone, they ignore me, and get a little, what's wrong with them? My self-esteem, why should they smile back? But anyway. But Baumeister says to really get a mass atrocity going, you need idealism. The belief that your violence is a means to a moral end. Idealism brings with it almost invariably the belief that the ends justify the means. And in contrast to this, Asian wisdom recognized that both opposing sides have value. So the idea of the yin and yang, or in Hindu belief, or belief isn't the right word, but Shiva, the god of creation, and Vishnu, the god of destruction, are opposites and need to be seen together. Okay, almost done. Although empathy and looking at a conflict from the opponent's point of view is highly encouraged, the material that Haight reviewed suggests that once anger comes into play, people find it extremely difficult to empathize with or to understand another person. Haight said a better place to start is, as Jesus advised, with yourself and the log in your own eye. Researchers found that de-biasing occurs only when subjects were forced to look at themselves. And he gives an example. He suggested we think of a recent interpersonal conflict with someone you care about and find one way in which your own behavior was not exemplary. Maybe you did something insensitive, even though you had a right to do it. Maybe you did something hurtful, even if you meant well. Or did something inconsistent with your principles, even though you could readily justify it. He compares it to a splinter. Said, when you extract the splinter, it hurts briefly, but then you experience relief, even maybe almost pleasure. Similarly, when you find a fault in yourself, it will hurt briefly, but if you keep going and acknowledge the fault, you are likely to be rewarded with a flash of pleasure, the pleasure of taking responsibility for your own behavior. He says it is the feeling of honor. So finding fault with yourself is also the key to overcoming the hypocrisy and judgmentalism that damage so many valuable relationships. The instant you see some contribution you made to a conflict, your anger softens, maybe just a bit. You can still believe you are right and the other person is wrong, but if you can move to believing you are mostly right and your opponent is mostly wrong, you have the basis for an effective and a non-humiliating apology. Reciprocity amplified by self-serving biases drive us apart. But we can turn the process around and use reciprocity to end a conflict and save a relationship. So these were some of the thoughts that came to me about this, and sort of like the conflict between Dot and the other chicken. How did they get beyond that? That's all I have, and I suggest that maybe for a few minutes, either with the person next to you or two people next to you, see if any of this makes sense to you, and let's do that, and we'll see what that ends up with, okay? Thank you.